Good morning. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. Real Life is the radio show that's dedicated to women who are ready to love life and make joy a part of the daily dialogue. So here we are, ladies, another Saturday morning, and this next 60 minutes can be just about you. I invite you to join me in getting your favorite beverage. This morning, I'm actually just having some water. So I invite you to get whatever feels good to you this morning and find a quiet place to let the next 60 minutes be just about you. When we think of Buddhism, some of us often think of silent monks in a remote Eastern location practicing and meditating, set aside from the world in which the rest of us live. But as Buddhism teaches us, this too is an illusion in today's world of socially engaged Buddhism. For those of you who still see Buddhism as primarily passive, my guest today, Sally King, is ready to open your eyes to a world in which the Buddhists are actively and intimately involved in issues that concern all of us. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining me this morning.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and you know, I want to let folks know what you are up to in the world and your life. And Sally is a professor of philosophy and religion at James Madison University in Harrisonburg, and she is the author of many books and articles on Buddhism and engaged Buddhism and some Quakerism, among many other things that I'm eager to hear about over this next 60 minutes, Sally.
So, great.
Yeah, so one of the questions I want to start with is, how big is the gulf between what people think of Buddhism and socially engaged Buddhism?
I think you put it correctly in the introduction that a lot of people think of Buddhism in terms of a religion that's very cut off from sort of practical everyday life. But I think people have a disconnect in their mind because at the same time, most people are familiar with the Dalai Lama, who is a part of engaged Buddhism, and I think most people recognize that he stands for compassion and kindness and a very universalistic worldview, and at the same time, they're aware, pretty aware, I think, that he is a kind of a figurehead and a leader in a movement to change the status of Tibet with respect to China, so that's a political issue. A lot of people are familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, who's the second most famous Buddhist teacher in the West. I don't know how many people know that he was a leader of the Buddhist movement during the war in Vietnam to try to bring that war to an end. And then beyond those two, I think what hardly anybody in this country knows is that they are just two of many, many Buddhists in all the Buddhist countries of the world, with the exception of a few where there's insufficient freedom, but most of the Buddhist countries then, where Buddhism is very much involved with all kinds of social and political issues.
What kinds of issues does the gap in that thinking create when you're teaching or writing or just interacting with people?
Well, I don't know that it creates any particular issues per se. And in fact, I think the fact that there is that gap is also partly being met from a different side, because Buddhism, as it is evolving in the West and in this country in particular, is already changing. You know, Buddhism started in India. It spread throughout Asia centuries ago, and now it is spreading to the West. And every time it comes to a new culture, it changes. So in addition to the engaged Buddhism movement that's very important and prominent in Asia, in this country, you already find Buddhism engaging in a somewhat new way with ordinary everyday life issues, issues of going to work, issues of relationships and people's personal emotional life, psychological issues. And this is new for Buddhism as well. So I think Buddhism is evolving very rapidly right now. It has some really outstanding leadership, both in the West and in Asia. So it's a very dynamic tradition. And when people start finding out about this, I think they're kind of pleased because in many ways, it makes Buddhism, I think, fulfill some of the things that Westerners expect of Buddhism, but maybe they didn't know they were going to find in there.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And if you're just joining us this morning, I am joined by Sally King, who is a professor of philosophy and religion at James Madison University. And she has also written a number of books on Buddhism and engaged Buddhism and Quakerism. And she's sharing her story. Sally, I'm really very interested to hear about your journey through, well, just your journey to finding engaged Buddhism. How did you start?
Well, for me, I got interested in Buddhism when I was an undergraduate student in college, and I was already interested in philosophy and religion and all the great questions in life, and I took a course on Buddhism, and it immediately spoke to me. I think that many people feel that way when they run into Buddhism. It just made a lot of sense, and I just followed it more and more, and I did graduate studies in the area, and ultimately I became a professor, and my specialty is Buddhism, but it took some while to find engaged Buddhism for me. It hadn't become that available, I think, in the West. So when I first found it was in reading Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Being Peace, which is a great classic of engaged Buddhism, and a lot of people know that book.
Yeah.
And I was quite taken by it at that time. So after that, my husband and I and our two children actually went to Plum Village in France, where Thich Nhat Hanh lives, and they have a summer open period when people are invited to come and stay for up to a month. And I was very curious at the time, actually, as a mother, to see what Buddhism had to offer children, because that was also something I couldn't find, and also something that I saw was going on in Thich Nhat Hanh's work. So the four of us went and spent a month in Plum Village, and I was really particularly interested, as I say, to see how the sort of family Buddhist practice and the practice for children was going to go, and that was quite delightful.
What was that? What was that like for children?
It just sort of grew on me from there, I guess.
What was the what were the practices as a family or for children? I'm interested to hear that too.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because this is, you know, part of the image that Buddhism has. And it's part of the difficulty, I think, for Western Buddhism, just because we haven't got the institutions really complete yet. But some of the practices there for children, well, for example, walking meditation. A lot of people know that Thich Nhat Hanh has popularized walking meditation, and he's changed it just a little bit. Everything he does changes things a little bit without ever, you know, losing the real heart and soul of the thing. So walking meditation becomes something you can do with your children and that children can enjoy. So it's walking out in nature and actually enjoying nature and really trying to immerse yourself, walking slowly. And if you want to stop and smell a flower, you do that. If you want to, you know, look at the beautiful blue sky, you do that. And so that's just a natural for children. So all kinds of families were there, these long lines of adults and children walking through the countryside, really enjoying it. And so this is also part of the flavor, I would say, of Thich Nhat Hanh's approach to Buddhism. Very enjoyable. And, of course, that makes it fun for kids. Thich Nhat Hanh always says he doesn't call a retreat a, what is it? He doesn't call a retreat a retreat. He calls it a treat.
Oh,
and
I love
so,
it. That's great.
The practice really is a treat. And so another thing, I still laugh when I think about it, he would have a tea ceremony, very different from the Japanese kind, which is very, very formal. The tea ceremony at Plum Village, the kids were there along with everybody, and we would have tea and cookies, and people would share songs, and everybody would sort of join in on the song and tell stories, and so it was very kid-friendly, and I remember my kids kind of, you know, sitting quietly, nodding, and then pass the cookies. So, you know, it was real. It was real kids being like real kids. And at the beginning of his Dharma talks, his talks on the teachings of Buddhism, he'd always take the first 10 minutes or so and really address the children, really speak on a level that children could understand. And then he would say, if you want to stay, you can stay and hear more. But if you want to leave and just go out and play, you can do that. Mm. So, you know, it was very, very appropriate for children. They developed some songs. Were very, very simple, short songs that would sort of capture the spirit of compassion, for example, to sort of, you know, a child could learn a very short song, and that would sort of keep the idea of compassion more toward the front of the mind, that sort of thing. So, you know, it was, as a mother, and I think my husband felt the same way as a father, it was just a wonderful place to be with children. And you don't think of that when you think of a Buddhist retreat, which is, in this case, a treat.
Sally, what practice were you able to bring back from the treat, as opposed to the retreat, that you found useful in your life as a parent?
Well, some of the practices were things like, one of them, Thich Nhat Hanh very frequently uses a bell of mindfulness. So at any moment, you might ring this bell of mindfulness just at random times through the day. This is in Plum Village. Mm-hmm. And then anyone who heard the bell would just stop whatever they were doing for a minute and sort of breathe and smile, as Thich Nhat Hanh says. So just become quiet and breathe quietly and sort of return to yourself and then go back to whatever you're doing. And he also recommended you can do this if there's a conflict in the family. You can just ring the bell. And, you know, if there's some kind of argument going on or something like that, everybody will sort of remember how they want to be and just take a moment and, you know, calm down and become quiet. And then after that sort of pause, then you can return, hopefully, in a sort of refreshed way to whatever the differences are about and work them out a little bit better. Things like that, things like having a sitting practice and inviting the children just to sit for even 1 minute or 2 minutes if they want, just to, you know, not feel that there's something mysterious here that they're excluded from, but that they're welcome to. Mm. That's a couple of examples.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And if you're just joining us this morning, I am joined by Sally King, who is a professor over at JMU in Harrisonburg, and she teaches philosophy and religion, and she's written a number of books on the same. Sally, you had told me that you are involved with some interreligious dialogue and organizations. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's something I've been interested in for a very long time, because one of my concerns, and it's a part of this concern with spiritually based engagement with the problems of the world, of course. As everyone's aware, religion plays a role in conflict. We'd like to think of it more. And when people talk about their own religion, it's always, yeah, my religion is all about peace. But somehow when religions get together, it's not all about peace. Mm. And so interreligious dialogue really, it's quite variable depending upon the religions involved. Sometimes it is about issues of how to get along in the world without blowing the world up, how to sort of make peace and agree to disagree in some ways and work out issues in other ways. Sometimes it's that kind of thing. Other times, interreligious dialogue is more personal. It's more about, we live in a religiously plural world, and now with people moving about as much as they do and electronic communications, we have opportunities to know about a multitude of religions, and I really think it is the case that many people may be born into one religion, but they find things of value in other religions as well. And so I think many people have a kind of an interreligious dialogue going on within themselves, and sometimes, I think most of the time, there's no problem with that, but then sometimes, you know, a question may come up where maybe a person might be drawing on two religions or influenced by two religions, and maybe they might seem to point in different directions about a particular issue or something like that, and then you start to wonder. So interreligious dialogue, I guess it's going on within an individual. It goes on between neighbors, in local communities, on the international level, so many different forms. And I think it's an important component in the world trying to sort itself out as things get more and more crowded and sort of more and more confusing in life.
So you personally practice, you're a practicing Quaker and Buddhist, and I know that you lead workshops combining those. How do you blend the two of those?
Well, the thing is, it's not just me by any means. Quakers have a national gathering once a year called Friends General Conference, and one year I was asked to speak at that conference on the subject of Quakerism and Buddhism. So I was standing in front of an audience, I think about, I don't know, maybe 1,500 people, something like that, all of them Quakers. And at the very start of my talk, I said, I know I'm not the only one who sees a kind of a connection here. And so I just invited anyone in the audience, if they, these Quakers, if they had in some way taken Buddhism into their spiritual lives, would they please stand up? And 85 to 90% of that room stood up. And I was just floored. I could hardly speak. I was so amazed. So there, I think it's fair to say many people do perceive this kind of connection because, well, both of these religions are ways that, well, for example, in Buddhism, there's something called Buddha nature, which is the idea that Buddhahood, which is wisdom and compassion, is within all of us, and our task in life is basically to get in touch with that and develop it and live it more and more. And in Quakerism, there's something called the light within, which is pretty similar, actually. It's technically speaking, it's the third person of the Trinity, the Holy Spirit, which Quakers feel is within each one of us. And so there's this sort of inner light, we often call it, which is similarly expressed in wisdom and, I guess the word there would be, love. And so both of these traditions really expect people to look within and get in touch with this sort of inner wisdom, this inner guide, and develop it. And because of that, they are, although both sides have scriptures, they take the scriptures as more or less guides, not as sort of absolute external authorities. So there's a lot in common, in fact.
You know, I lead Dances of Universal Peace, and what I find, and what that is sacred phrases and mantras taken from the different spiritual traditions from around the world and set to beautiful melody and simple movement. And I find, in my experience over the last 20 years, is that so many of the messages from all of the traditions are common.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm very sympathetic to that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the messages are very similar when you get down to it. And as far as I'm concerned, the various religions are more or less methods of approaching the divine, if you use that language, methods of getting in touch with truth. And so as far as I'm concerned, the best thing to do, and this is much like what the Dalai Lama says, he says this all the time, you have to find the method or the path that really works for you. But there is a sense that when you do find a path that works for you, then it kind of runs parallel in a lot of ways to other paths. They're all about, in a sense, finding something greater than ourselves as individuals and trying experientially to get our this sense of the ego self out of the center of the picture and have something else more in the forefront of our minds.
So for many of my listeners this morning, Sally, ego self might be a new term that we're not familiar with, and I'm hoping you can illuminate us.
Okay. It's a kind of a big subject, so I'm just kind of wondering how to talk about it. Yeah. If I speak about it from a Buddhist point of view, the idea is that, well, let me put it this way. In American culture, compared to some other cultures, we are an extremely individualistic culture.
Mm-hmm.
Some other cultures are more sort of communitarian. The individual gets more of his or her identity from the group. We are extremely individualistic. That has its pros and cons. But the downside of it is that the individual, or the ego self, put it that way, can feel pretty alone and sometimes threatened by all sorts of things outside. And certainly from a Buddhist point of view, it's a bit of a mistake. It's more than a bit of a mistake. It's a big mistake to understand ourselves as so alone and so much an individual, so totally separate from other people, totally separate from the environment, from the world, from society. We're in fact very much interdependent, interconnected with other people and with the world that we live in. But this whole sense of aloneness, fear, anxiety, that's a manifestation of an ego self that's pretty unhappy, in fact. So a lot of Buddhism, and I think a lot of religions, are about putting us more in contact with things other than ourselves, with other people, with the divine, if it's a religion that speaks in terms of the divine, with the world, with society.
You know, I just saw a beautiful movie this past week that's reminding me of what you're talking about, and it's called The Lost Boys of Sudan. And if anybody listening hasn't heard it, I strongly recommend it. I got it through Netflix. And basically, I won't go into the whole story, but the reason for the reminder is that there were some number of young men who came from Sudan to the United States, and they were used to being in community all day, all day, all day, all day. And in fact, you know, they slept in rooms where there were many people. And so when they came to this country, they started to feel very isolated, and some of them didn't thrive as a result. There were starting to be some mental health issues because he said, I don't see my roommate for 3 weeks because of their work schedules and how everything was working. So, and you know, I personally am on a kick reminding women to reach out, to remember that we are part of community and that we don't have to go through difficult times alone or go through joyful times alone. We are, and I think in our culture and for us women, it is really easy to isolate when things start feeling hard. I really appreciate your pointing out the sense of community. And Sally, we need to take a short break here, and I encourage you, the listener, to stay tuned, because when we come back, Sally King will be my guest for the second half of the show. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And this morning, Sally King is joining me. She is a professor of philosophy and religion at JMU, and sharing with us her stories and her journey around engaged Buddhism. Sally, I was hoping you might be able to lead us all in a practice this morning.
Sure, I'd be very happy to.
Great, thank you.
I think maybe an appropriate one that we could do just for a couple of minutes over the air, very basic Buddhist meditation practice is the breath meditation. Most Buddhist traditions have this as part of the tradition, and it's a good practice for beginners. It's a good practice for anybody. As you'll see, for one thing, it gets you in touch with your body and sort of takes us out of our thoughts, constant thoughts, and more into our whole being, including our body. So should we go ahead and start that?
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay. So anybody who wants to do this, the practice begins with being in a comfortable position. It's never about, twisting up your legs into some uncomfortable posture. You can just sit very naturally in the chair that you're sitting in with both feet on the ground and just comfortable but alert. And then to do the breath meditation, you can start to breathe just naturally and watch as you breathe the physical sensation, the physical feeling in your body of what that breathing feels like to you. So you can, as you breathe in, maybe you feel your abdomen expanding as you inhale. Maybe you feel then after that your chest expanding. You can feel the air passing through the nostrils as you breathe in. And so you just focus your mind on those physical movements and sensations, what it feels like to you as you do the breathing. And similarly, as you breathe out, you can feel the air passing through the nostrils, and you can feel it sort of the lungs almost deflating and the chest kind of settling and the abdomen kind of contracting. And that's really all you do. So just, again, focusing the attention, focusing the mind on that sensation, what it feels like to breathe in. Trying to put all your attention there on what that feels like. Just breathing very naturally. And then again, as you breathe out, very naturally, just watching. What does that feel like in the nostrils, in the chest, in the abdomen? So just breathing in and out at a natural pace, but being aware moment by moment by moment, what is the feeling in this moment and then the next moment, and we observe how it's changing moment by moment. And of course it helps to calm one down. If you weren't calm to start with, as you sort of breathe comfortably, naturally, the breaths get longer and slower and deeper. Very relaxing at the same time that it gets sort of more and more interesting and intriguing as you see, oh, there's all of these things going on in the body with each breath. And so a person can do that kind of breathing meditation just very naturally in the middle of the day, going about the business. Maybe you're waiting in line for something. Maybe you're sitting at a red light in the car. You can always just, even for a few seconds, turn the attention to the breathing, the sensations of breathing, and it's very relaxing. It's very grounding. Again, takes you out of your head, puts you in your body.
Thank
you. That's it. Very simple.
Thank you, Sally. That was wonderful.
Very welcome.
Yeah. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And Sally King is taking us on a journey here with practices, replete with practices, around the topic of engaged Buddhism. Sally, when we met, you were giving a talk here in Charlottesville about engaged Buddhism, and you were telling us a story about an encounter that you had in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Would you share that with us?
Absolutely. I was fortunate enough to go to Jerusalem with a group called the Peace Council, which is an international interfaith organization that tries to demonstrate that the world's religions can cooperate and help to build peace, and they don't necessarily need to be in conflict. So this was an interfaith group that went to Jerusalem, and it was very interesting from a Buddhist point of view. Of course, it's interesting from any point of view, obviously, but there was an additional level of interest. The Buddhists in the group, all of us were listening to stories from the Palestinians who were there and telling their stories about their difficulties under the occupation and the loss of their homes. And then we heard many stories from Israelis and the difficulties of being surrounded by hostile neighbors and coming out of the Holocaust experience and this kind of thing. And this went on for a few days, and after a while, I noticed that all the Buddhists in the group, and including myself, were starting to squirm a little bit, metaphorically speaking. I could tell we were all starting to squirm, and it wasn't clear what we were squirming about until finally one of the Buddhists present spoke up, and this was a woman, in fact. She was a lay woman, a Buddhist scholar at the time. She since has become a Buddhist nun named Venerable Dhammananda. And she spoke up and she said, with reference to both the Israelis and the Palestinians, "I cannot understand in my heart what they're saying. They seem to be nourishing their suffering, and I've been taught to let it go."
Love
and all
that.
The Buddhists kind of nodded their heads. And we were, at the same time, we were all blown away by that because, you know, the Buddhists were very compassionate, but it was clear that they felt the way both sides were handling this difficult situation seemed to be contributing to the problem somehow, this sense of nourishing their suffering, keeping it going, handing it on to the next generation, taking so much of their identity, each one of them, from, you know, sort of seeing themselves as victims, suffering victims in this situation. It just seemed to add to the whole dynamic of the problem. And then after that, we went to... it was, in fact, Holocaust Memorial Day, and our whole group went to Hebrew University, and we went and heard a program on the Holocaust, and it was extremely emotional, really hours of songs and poems out of the death camps and, you know, people's stories of just unimaginable horror and suffering, and yet, you know, their humanity continuing through all of that. So very moving. And then after that, we went in a separate room with some of the university officials. And much to everyone's surprise, because none of this was scripted, one of the Buddhists present, a Tibetan Lama named Geshe Sopa, a very distinguished and extremely well-educated Tibetan Buddhist monk, started to speak to these Jewish officials of the university, and he said something like this. He said, "You know, we Tibetans have also suffered a great deal, and we were invaded by the Chinese, and the Chinese took over our land and took our homes, and many, many people died, and many people imprisoned and tortured and all this kind of thing." And he said, "We Tibetans believe that that was the product of our karma, the product of our collective karma, that sometime in the past, in past lives, we Tibetans had done something terrible to the Chinese, and what we're suffering now is the consequence of those deeds. What we're suffering from the Chinese is the consequence of things we did to the Chinese in past lives." But he said, "You know, beyond all of that, the important thing is to remember to have compassion for wrong things that are done out of ignorance, out of a hating, ignorant mind. A person does terrible things, and we have to have compassion for everyone in the situation. So we Tibetans do not hate the Chinese. We try to look for a solution that's going to work for everyone." And then he said to the Jewish leaders who were present, he said, "You might consider, you know, perhaps in the past you were German soldiers who did terrible things to Jewish people. And so what you're suffering now and what you suffered in the Holocaust and so forth may have been a result of your karma. And so, again, perhaps you might consider looking for a solution that is going to work for everyone, and to remember compassion for all people involved. Mm-hmm. And we were all just, all of us listening to Geshe Sopa speak, we were just, again, blown away, completely blown away. Didn't know what was going to happen next. And in fact, nothing happened next because everyone in the room was really so stunned by what they heard. Mm. I think everyone present just had to process it. And that was going to take a long time. And then just to finish the story, the very next day we went, our interfaith group went to a Palestinian refugee camp. And in meeting with the Palestinian leaders at that camp, Geshe Sopa, again, non-scripted, just went ahead and gave a very similar speech. And again, that was met with, you know, everyone present being quite stunned. Mm. So that was just a really amazing example to me, I think to everyone present, of a very different approach that these Buddhists were taking to a global conflict, life and death kind of situation.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And this morning my guest is Sally King, who is a professor of philosophy and religion, and she's joining us from JMU, James Madison University, over in Harrisonburg. Sally, what is it that you personally would like to accomplish with your engagement, with your participation in what you're doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, my personal view is it's not that I think the Buddhists have all the answers to all the questions. I don't think that. I think that what's happening in this amazing time in which we all live is that there is an unprecedented meeting going on between Western ways of thinking and being and doing and Asian and maybe especially Buddhist ways of thinking and doing and being. And so I think that each side has a great deal potentially to learn from each other. I think each side has its strengths, and what we need to do is to try to hear each other clearly and, take it all in from our own cultural point of view and just then, you know, see how we respond. So my own small contribution is to bring some of these Asian Buddhist insights into a Western sort of cultural framework of thought and experience, and to look at them from the point of view of our culture and see what we have to learn, and then also to engage the Buddhist side, which I do when I'm speaking with that kind of audience, and maybe challenge some of their ideas or approaches from a Western point of view, and see if there might be anything helpful in any of that for the Buddhist side.
Thank you for doing that.
Well, it's obviously a great pleasure and a great privilege.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the struggles that I personally have with the idea of social engagement, perhaps, is the balance between, and I'm constantly looking for this balance between accepting what is so, mm-hmm. and then proactively taking action to change what is so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question, and in fact, and this connects with the interreligious dialogue question. I've been invited to speak this coming summer in England at a Buddhist-Christian dialogue, and the question they're focusing on and that I've been asked to speak about from an engaged Buddhist perspective is hope.
Hmm.
And when I was, you know, invited and said, this is the topic, you know, what can you say about hope from an engaged Buddhist point of view, I really started the gears turning in my mind, I must say, because you know, Buddhists don't speak that language. That's a Christian language, this language of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, obviously they engage, and we haven't even mentioned, you know, there's engaged Buddhism in so many Buddhist countries, and they do everything from trying to get people out of deep poverty. I mean, the poverty in some Asian countries is you know, devastating poverty, and providing free medical care in some countries, and working against sexism in some countries, and caste system in some countries, or the environmental crisis in other countries. And so obviously, in some way, there's some kind of hope, if that's the right word, which, you know, there really is not an equivalent in the Buddhist languages. But obviously you don't engage unless you think something can happen. So in point of fact, what I see going on in Buddhism is it's rather subtle, but I think it's grounded in meditation practice, the difference, so that even that breathing meditation we did a few minutes ago, it's really based on looking at the present moment and accepting what is in the present moment without resistance. And so breath is pretty easy. There's not a lot to resist in breathing.
Yeah. Mm.
But we do the same practice with our emotions and maybe a physical pain in the body or thoughts in the mind. And all of these, the practice is to see what's there, to recognize it, to take a really good look and see it clearly. And then the next step is to accept that it's there. But here's the pivot point. We need to accept what's there in the present moment and recognize it, acknowledge it. But the point is, the next moment is open. We do not know what the next moment will have in it. That is a surprise. And in point of fact, Buddhists talk a lot about karma. Karma is basically cause and effect. So if I want the next moment to be different, I need to do something in this moment, which will be a cause that helps to create the next moment. It's not the only thing that creates the next moment, but it plays a role. So there's this balance, and that's a good word that you use, between accepting this moment is the way it is. That's absolutely true, and we absolutely have to accept it, or if we try to resist, it's just creating another level of pain for us. So there's no use in that. So we accept the present moment, but then we recognize the next moment is open, and let's apply an intelligent action in this moment that'll help to maybe shift things in a new direction in the next moment. All of that is part of, it's really based in Buddhist meditation and the Buddhist worldview, and it applies directly to any and all kinds of social action.
Thank you. That's such a great just reminder of what's possible, you know, that and that we can be part of creating the what's possible in a positive
way. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is a place where engaged Buddhism has its own work to do in Asian countries and also in the West. When people begin to hear about karma, they think it's all about fate, that like the story I told from Geshe Sopa, well, things are happening now because of things that I did in the past. That's true. But the real focus in Buddhism is, as Geshe Sopa said, I need to be compassionate right now because that's going to affect the future. And so it's true that things are coming at us in the Buddhist view because of things that have happened in the past. And you don't have to be a Buddhist to say, yeah, things in this life that I've done have certainly, you know, helped to create this moment for me. But really the focus is on, now what am I going to do right now? And that's going to set up the next moment. So it's very empowering when you get that kind of future focus.
Yes, yeah. Sally, we just have a couple of minutes left. What is the one thing that you would like our listeners to take away from our conversation this morning?
The one thing is hard to come up with. I guess let me just focus on the idea of spirituality and social action going hand in hand. A lot of people, when they hear about engaged Buddhism, and they think, oh, they've forgotten all about the spirituality and the meditation and the inner peace, and they're just running around doing all these things in the world. That would be another mistaken view. In point of fact, and it's kind of responding to your last question and the balance as well, there has to be a balance between spirituality and social action. You know, you don't want to turn your back on the world because that's where we live.
Yeah.
That is where our life is. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, obviously you don't want to turn your back on your spirituality. And so what you're doing is expressing your spirituality just in your life, in your actions. And that's one form of engagement. It doesn't mean you have to go out into the streets and protest, but just the way we interact with each other, the kind of choices we make, you know, every day throughout our lives, whether we, you know, try to make a point of one act of kindness every day. It's a very simple thing to do that anyone can do, and it's an expression of our spirituality. It helps to create us as kinder people every day, and it improves the world that we live in. So maybe that's my thought to leave all of us with, and to remind myself as well to be mindful each day. One intentional act of kindness.
That's all the time we have this morning. Sally King, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's really been delightful.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, and thank you for spending part of your weekend with me. Remember to log on to jennifertilt.com, where you can subscribe to the Real Life Podcast. And until next Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, remember to ask yourself, what's the kindest thing I can do for me right now? See you next week.